in 1942, I was a member of a good platoon. We were on maneuvers in Louisiana one night by the light of the moon. The captain told us to ford a river, that's how it all begun. We were knee-deep in the big muddy, the big fool said to push on. Well, the sergeant said, sir, are you sure this is the best way back to the base? Sergeant, go on, I forded this river about a mile above this place. It'll be a little soggy, but just keep slogging, we'll soon be on dry ground. We were waist-deep in the big muddy, the big fool said to push on. Well, the sergeant said, sir, with all this equipment, no man will be able to swim. Sergeant, don't be nervous, Nelly, the captain said to him. All we need is a little determination, men, follow me, I'll lead on. We were neck deep in the big muddy, the big fool said to push on. Well, all at once the moon clouded over, we heard a gurgling cry. A few seconds later, the captain's helmet was all that floated by. The sergeant said, turn around, men, I'm in charge from now on. And we just made it out of the big muddy, with the captain dead and gone. We stripped and dived and found his body stuck in the old quicksand. I guess he didn't know that the water was deeper than the place he'd once before been. Another stream had joined the big muddy about a half mile from where we'd gone. We were lucky to escape from the big muddy when the big fools had to push on. Well, I'm not going to point any moral, I'll leave that for yourself. Maybe you're still walking, you're still talking, you'd like to keep your health. But every time I read the paper, them old feelings come on. We're waist-deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Waist-deep, neck-deep, soon even a tall man will be over his head. We're waist-deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on.
Welcome, and thank you for listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Today's program features Lawrence Lessig, who joins Bob McChesney to talk about institutional corruption. Lawrence Lessig is a professor of law at Harvard Law School. His current work concerns institutional corruption and the economy of influence that weakens the effectiveness of an institution or weakens the public trust in it.
Our guest today, Lawrence Lessig. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters. Lawrence Lessig is a professor of law at Harvard Law School, author of the brand new book, Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Congress, and a Plan to Stop It. We've got another half hour to talk with Professor Lessig. The number here at WILLAM 580 is 217-333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines. We have a couple of callers who have been waiting patiently. Let's start line two, Champaign. You're on the air with Larry Lessig.
Yeah, just two issues. Your comment. You're talking about K Street, the influence, but what about the influence of Glover Norquist on the Republican Party? And the other issue is that I didn't realize until recently that Congress doesn't have to pay by the rules in terms of insider trading. Congress is legal for them to do that. So there's two issues, and thank you.
Thank you very much, caller. Larry Lessig?
So Grover Norquist is an interesting character. He both is a, you could think of as a public policy advocate, you know, on the right. He leads a tax organization that has created the pledge that most Republicans have taken never to raise any taxes. And from that standpoint, you know, I disagree with the policy, but no one can disagree with the freedom of people to kind of run and lead public policy movements and to get as many people behind them as they can. But Norquist also has an interesting lobbying practice, or is supported in part, in effect, for lobbying. And that practice itself benefits when he can push Congress in a direction leveraging the tax pledge to support his clients. So, for example, let's imagine that there was a client who was getting a huge subsidy from the government to support ethanol production. You know, probably one of the dumbest things our government ever did, but there it is. The government has subsidized ethanol production, both not a green fuel, and an extraordinary expense and that has the effect of raising the price of food for no good reason. Okay, might be controversial in some parts of the country, maybe in your part of the country where this this comes from, but that's my view. There's the subsidy for ethanol production. If somebody comes along and says, let's eliminate the subsidy, and that's what Tom Coburn, a Republican in the United States Senate, has tried to do, does the elimination of a subsidy constitute a tax increase? Well, the Norcrest Group has basically said, yeah, it constitutes a tax increase, and if you increase taxes, you're violating the tax pledge, and if you violate the tax pledge, we will bring out our full guns to defeat you because we're going to defeat everybody who violates their tax pledge. And in my view, these two worlds are now a little bit too closely aligned, because it's one thing to have a principled view about the tax pledge. It's another thing to be benefiting personally from effectively lobbying in a way that is advancing really a crazy position about the need to continue government subsidies, no matter what the craziness of those subsidies are. So I think Norquist is an extremely important point about how this all connects into the system of corruption that is Washington. Although I have no criticism for people like Norquist advancing particular political views, even if I disagree with them. The issue about inside trading is a little bit, I think actually a little bit complicated. There's some really good empirical work that's looking at all of the trades of congressmen and finding that on average, congressmen actually don't do better than the market. So it's a little contested, I think, whether in fact they're trading on inside information, but I completely agree they should be subject to the same rules. And I think we should go further. There's no reason why we should live in a world where we wonder at all about whether Congress is benefiting from the, you know, the of necessity inside information they're exposed to. And so I think the critical thing to do is to have rules that require that when congressmen go to Congress, they've got to put their assets in a context that nobody could wonder whether they are trading in a way to benefit themselves personally. And many, you know, wealthier members of Congress do this already. They put their stuff into blind trust. But we should be able to make that process automatic and simple so that effectively everybody is doing that.
Our guest, Larry Lessig. This is Media Matters. Let's go to our next caller now. Line 1, Slaterville Springs, New York. You're on the air.
Hi. About 7 or 8 years ago, I called in to Media Matters and talked with Professor Lessig about the application of copyrights to genetic-related things. And I'm still working as a public servant in agricultural genetics. And I'm happy to say the work that I've done, we've been able to give away to the best possible benefit in line with the ideals of the Constitution. Your latest book arrived here on Friday, and I haven't read it yet, but I'm hopeful about the book and about a particular thing. So I speak with, you know, talk to my father regularly, and we talk about, you know, what's going on in the world and what's changed in his lifetime and in mine. And he gets very, very frustrated to the point where he really just can't talk about it anymore. And my question is, do you think that the ideas in your book can reach people like my dad that are just looking for an answer, looking for a plan to make our republic better? And secondly, if you I'm sure you do think so, but if you do think so, you know, can is there a way we can buy your book in bulk and get it out there?
Thank you very much, caller. Larry, I'm sure you like calls like that.
Yeah. You know, writing a book, as I'm sure you imagine, is extremely difficult. It's hard to find the right voice and the right for the right audience. And I certainly tried to write this book in a way that my own dad, who also is extremely frustrated by a wide range of things in this current democracy, could understand and act on. So the answer to the first part of your question is, I hope so. It was my intent, and I worked harder on this book than anything I've ever written before. So I hope I've gone some distance to achieving that. With respect to the second part, well, you know, my contract with my publisher permits me at a point we haven't agreed upon yet, but I hope soon to make my book freely licensed under a Creative Commons license. And so then at that point, yes, you can get it in bulk for free. Before then, you know, I'm amazed with how cheaply these things get made available. I understand that Public Campaign, starting tomorrow, is going to be making it available for $10 to everybody on its list. I think it's $16 on Amazon right now. I think that you can buy it in bulk for $14, you know, if you buy it through BookPal or something like that. But, you know, I think the key thing is to get people motivated to be caring about this issue, and that's the hardest thing. It's not the cost of the book. It's the recognition that people have to have that this is the root problem, and we have to figure out a way to solve it. And here's one try, one effort, one step towards solving it. But, you know, certainly I don't think mine is the last word, and I don't believe that, you know, my plan is going to be the end of this conversation. I just hope the beginning.
Professor Lessig, one of the passages in your book I found most interesting was your discussion of your attitude toward relationship with the Obama candidacy and the Obama administration. If I can summarize, I sense it was one of initially considerable hope and enthusiasm, and then once in power, less enthusiasm and a certain amount of dissatisfaction. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but explain, you know, your relationship there, your attitude, and what it means going forward.
So that's an understatement. I certainly, you know, Obama was a colleague of mine at Chicago. He was a friend. I worked on I supported every campaign he ever ran for. I worked to help get him elected president. I was most excited about the presidential campaign, not because I thought he was a liberal. I don't know why anybody really thought he was a liberal, but because I thought he was going to run a non-conventional presidency in the sense of a presidency devoted to the objective of changing the way Washington works. It's what he said again and again in my book. I pull, you know, just some of the quotes of him sort of identifying the problem in the way Washington works, tied to the power of lobbyists, that this is the reason he was running for president, to change the system. And I thought that's, in fact, what he was going to do. He was going to get into office and execute on a plan to change the way the system works so that we could get back to a democracy where people had a reason to trust what government did. From day one, it was clear he didn't actually have a plan, and he didn't actually expect to execute on a plan. It was from day one, it was suggested, and pretty quickly into the administration, it became obvious that the rhetoric about changing the system was just that. It was rhetoric. It was a way to distinguish himself from Hillary Clinton and get a bunch of us who were eager to see reform help him rather than help the presumptive Democratic nominee, Hillary Clinton. Now, you know, you can have lots of excuses about how, oh, geez, we were in the middle of a crisis, there was too much going on, who could be executing on a plan. But I think it would be forgivable if we saw the administration trying to bring about the kind of changes that would change the corruption of the system and failing. But I think what's not excusable is absolutely dodging the whole effort to transform the system. And what that's left us with is an enormously frustrated public, especially the people who voted for him, who think, you know, I voted for change, and what change was there? You know, and I think that just will induce more of the cynicism that I think already infects our government.
Yeah, I think that was some of the best writing in the book, in the collection of quotes you did, Larry, if I may say so. And I think your point, I agree with it completely, having spoken to lots of people who aren't especially political necessarily, but who strongly supported Obama precisely on the idea that we're going to clean up the system, and he meant what he was saying. And I sometimes wonder if the Rahm Emanuels and Geithners and Summers and Obamas of the world really understand that people actually took that stuff seriously, and that there are a lot of really angry people out there.
Yeah, I had this experience in July, just after I finished the book. I was in Aspen, and David Axelrod sat down next to me for breakfast, and I felt like this is a Marshall McLuhan moment. and so I turned to him and I said, you know, so what was the plan? You know, what was the plan? You made this whole deal about changing the way the system works, and what was the plan? And it was clear from him there was no plan. He told the story about how Obama, in his first budget, was upset because there were 7,000 earmarks in the budget, and he said he was going to veto the budget. And his staffers told him, "No way you can veto this budget. You know, you can't burn your bridges with the Democrats. You can't veto this." And I think that was a critical moment where, you know, had he vetoed this budget and come out strongly and said, this system is going to change and we're not going to play this game the way it's been played for the last 25 years, he would have been the Tea Party. He would have been the person symbolizing the radical transformation of this government that's necessary. But it was clear they didn't have a plan for doing it. They didn't have the stomach for doing it. They just didn't execute it. But I think that the more fundamental point that you make is really absolutely clear. At the same table was Joe Klein, you know, who obviously has been paying attention to presidential insider games forever. And Klein said to me, "What are you talking about? I don't remember Obama talking anything about reform. Why do you think that was the issue of the campaign?" And I was astonished. I was, you know, because I had done the research and reading every single one of his speeches and pulling out the time and again and again and again about him talking about reform. But the insiders to this system are so used to this rhetoric that they don't even hear it anymore. You know, it's just like the Pledge of Allegiance in the morning at school. You know, it's just a ritual you do. And you know, if anybody stopped and said, "Really? You're pledging? This is what you're saying?" They would say, you don't understand what this is for. This is just a ritual we do. And that's what I think normal politicians think about this reform rhetoric. It's just a ritual. Nobody should take it seriously. You're naive if you take it seriously. And I think what we have to do is we have to turn around and say, you're naive if you think you're going to get away with playing this Lucy-like game every single election cycle where you tell us to run and kick the football and pull it and we, Charlie Brown, fall on our back. You know, I think it's time for Charlie Brown to stand up and say enough.
I mean, to some extent, as I hear you say that, Larry Lessig, I mean, I look at the Occupy movement that's going on in the country, and in a way, it seems like that is sort of the First Amendment response to having the rules rigged in Washington, just to go out and say, we're going to just let you know that's not cutting the mustard anymore.
Yeah, and I think that if the Occupy movements were to frame themselves in this way and begin to talk in a way about the corruption of the system and the need to fix that corruption, they could connect to a wide range of other political grassroots movements that share this view but don't necessarily share the substantive political values of most in the Occupy movement. I haven't seen good evidence yet that the movement is going to mature to be able to do that well, but I think that if it did, it could be the beginning of something quite important.
Our guest, Larry Lessig, Harvard Law School professor, author of the brand new book, Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It, just published by 12 Books. Let's go back to the phone lines for another caller. Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air with Larry Lessig.
Yeah, I just wanted to say I agree completely with everything you said about Obama. But I heard you on the Diane Reams show, and you were quite good on that, quite good there. It's great to hear that coming from Washington, D.C. And but I wanted to know, you had mentioned something about a voucher system for campaign finance, and I was wondering if you could reiterate it here, and I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much, caller.
Yeah, thank you for the kind words and the opportunity. Yes. So if the problem is we have a system where the funders are not the people, one way to make the funders the people is to adopt a version of a small-dollar public finance system. So, you know, we have something close to this in Arizona and Maine and Connecticut for state elections. But the version that I describe in my book would apply to federal elections. And it basically works like this. The first thing you've got to assume, and we can argue about this, but I think it's easy to show it's true, is that every voter contributes at least $50 to the federal treasury. So take that first $50 that each of us sends to the federal treasury, whether through income tax or payroll tax or Social Security tax, and rebate it in the form of a democracy voucher. And with that democracy voucher, we can then fund congressional campaigns, give it to a candidate for Congress, so long as that candidate for Congress agrees to take only democracy vouchers plus up to $100 from any citizen in a contribution to support the campaign. So campaigns would be funded in this system either through $50 democracy vouchers or through contributions maxed out at $100. Now, if a majority of candidates opted into this system, and when Connecticut launched its system, more than 80% of candidates opted into it in the first year. But if a majority, a significant majority, let's say 65% of Congress, opted into this system, then the critical thing to recognize is that whatever reason Congress might have had for doing something stupid, which it, you know, inevitably will do, whether it's because there are too many Democrats or too many Republicans, the one thing it would be impossible to believe was that it was because of the money, because we had removed money from the central driving focus of Congress as they raised their election, they raised the money for their election, or at least more precisely, we would have removed the big dollar contributions that come from the tiniest slice of America from the mix of this election, and instead we'd have a system where they're funding their election from the broad range of us who are, you know, doing something with our democracy vouchers. So $50 a voter is more than $6 billion. That's 2.5 times the total amount raised in 2010. And that means it's a significant amount of money. It could actually have a significant effect in changing the way Congress funds its elections. And it would give us an opportunity to actually believe in what Congress does when it acts after being elected by small dollar funds only.
Larry, one of the things you just pointed out earlier is that such a small percentage of people actually make large donations, individual donations, not to mention the corporate and Citizen United stuff going on, that it, for most Americans, and you put this in the book well, I think it's rational that they sort of tune out and say, well, this isn't my game. I'm not a player here. I have no role to play. It's all for big money. And I think that dissuades a lot of people from wanting to participate. But the other point I face personally, and I know friends I've talked to face, is sometimes there's a politician you really would like to give money to, whatever it is, you really think they're great. But you realize that in a close race, maybe 60, 70, 80% of that money is going to go to a television station to run some idiotic, insulting, offensive, stupid ad. And it just sort of burns your butt that you're having to pay money. You're giving money that's going to go to a TV station for a license to public spectrum to run an idiotic ad.
Yeah, and, you know, obviously I learned most of my spectrum skepticism reading from, you know, the endless amounts of fantastic work you've done in this area. So I don't need to tell you and probably your listeners either about the craziness of the way in which we've allocated spectrum and have not at least benefited from the public for that allocation. But the one thing that is obvious, and I think you nicely pointed this too in the I can't remember exactly the title. It's a very clever title. Your last book, The Decline and
Rise Death and Life.
Yeah, The Death and Life of
American Journalism.
American Journalism. You know, it was one thing. It would be one thing in 1970 to be focusing on the public airwaves, but it's a different story today, because even if you were to liberate the public airwaves in the sense that you could say the public airwaves have to be devoted to you know, free advertising for political candidates, an increasing percentage of what people are consuming has nothing to do with the public airwaves. So, you know, cable television or the internet have a different relationship to this underlying argument about the public ownership of the basic resource, because we might own spectrum, but we don't necessarily own the fiber that gets laid from our house to some switching box. So I think we need a more general solution that cuts across these different property platforms and, you know, creates a funding system we can trust and have reason to believe in. I agree with you that I think most of what gets spent, the money gets spent on in political campaigns right now, is hard to have much excitement about, and nothing that I'm talking about is actually going to change that much. Maybe if we had a different kind of tenor or rigor to our politics by eliminating the need to be so polarized, that might actually help us solve that.
Larry Lessig, our guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Lessig is a professor of law at Harvard Law School, author of the new book, Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It. Phone lines are open at 217-333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Larry, you discuss this a bit in the book, and I think it's a point that I'm greatly interested in and want to see more work on down the road, and we'll hopefully do programs on this, which is our judicial system is also being greatly transformed right now. And in research I'm doing for another book with John Nichols right now, we've been looking at how the judicial system in America was perceived. And it's becoming clearer to me that the notion that I grew up with, and I suspect you did, that, you know, the court system basically was fair and just and worked, has not always been that case. That in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, the judicial system was considered extraordinarily corrupt and on the take. And that it really was cleaned up significantly in the middle parts of the 20th century. And now it seems like we're heading back into a zone where the trust in our judicial system is shrinking dramatically, not just with appointed judges who are politicized, as with the Supreme Court, but in these state elections where there's just an enormous amount of money going and flooding these elections, almost all coming from, you know, commercial interest. And where does that fit into your argument?
You can hear great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. General George Patton rallies support for war bonds in 1945.
Mayor, General Doolittle, soldiers, ladies and gentlemen, coming over here, there was a very great lesson. The first 4 hours, we passed over a destroyed land, utterly destroyed. You who have not seen it do not know what hell looks like from the top. That's what Germany looks like. That's what Austria looks like. That's what any place that the 8th Air Force and the 3rd Army worked on looks like. You must remember this. That from Brest to various towns in southern Germany and Austria, whose names I can't pronounce, but whose places I have removed. The trail of the 3rd Army and the 19th Tactical Air Command and the 8th Air Force is marked by more than 40,000 white crosses.
More from Great Speeches and Interviews after these messages.